Okay, everyone, so let's start the talk. And tonight I thought I was going to talk about identity, a very important topic in Buddhism. And the reason why I want to talk about this is because just under 2 weeks ago I became an Australian citizen. So I'm now an Aussie, Ferdinand Aussie. So, and it's interesting when you kind of become a citizen like that, because obviously I straight away I thought, what actually does make you an Aussie? Am I supposed to feel like an Aussie now? What does it mean to feel like an Aussie anyway? Does it feel different from being a Norwegian or a Sri Lankan or whatever? Or is it kind of roughly the same feeling? What does it actually mean? And it kind of got me thinking about the idea of identity. What is this thing we call identity? And it was a very nice ceremony, a kind of Australian ceremony, and we sang the Australian national anthem, Advance Australia Fair, and we had this little Australian flags. Everyone was waving little Australian flags. I felt obliged to wave the Australian flag as well, so I also waved an Australian flag. It was all very sweet and very nice, and then that was it. And then I was Australian after that, and suddenly I had changed from being Norwegian to being dual citizen after that. And it made me think again, what does it actually mean, this thing about identity? How does it relate to the Buddha's teachings? One of the ways that occurred to me straight away, or how to decide what is your identity, at least as far as nationality is concerned, is what kind of sports team do you support? That's kind of the usual how we identify who we are. So if you see the Australian cricket team winning, how do you feel about that? You feel, yay, Australia won. Maybe if you have a Sri Lankan background, you don't think like that. Maybe you think you're still holding on to the Sri Lankan identity, perhaps, if you're born in Sri Lanka. But for me, when I hear the Australian cricket team winning, what do I feel? I feel nothing. I have no relationship to cricket. I don't know anything about cricket. Cricket doesn't mean anything to me. And Australia, Australia's kind of neutral. It's neither good nor bad. It's pretty neutral as far as I'm concerned. But when I hear some Norwegian person winning in some kind of sport, sometimes I catch myself and thinking, yay, Norwegian won the sport. That is kind of one way or any way of kind of figuring out what kind of thing you identify with deep down. But the reality is, I don't really, when I think of myself as kind of supporting a Norwegian sports person or whatever, I'm not really proud of that. I'm not really, I must admit, when I see that in myself, I feel almost a bit embarrassed because I feel it is so limiting to kind of narrow yourself down to one nationality, to one particular person. And I know as soon as you narrow yourself down, you are excluding others. All the other people there are kind of out of the equation because of that. If you're supporting the Australian cricket team, if the Sri Lankans or win, or the English or the New Zealanders or whatever, if they win, you feel really bad, but they are really happy. But if you win, then you are happy and they are bad. And if they feel bad, you couldn't care less. Isn't that right? If your team wins, you don't care less about whether the other team feels bad or not. So it makes us become a bit selfish. We become a bit self-centered when there is the sense of identity. We forget about the suffering of the other part. It's all very innocent. It's just sport. It doesn't really matter all that much. It's not so. But it says something about our identity. And it's just the beginning of something which can get far, far worse if we allow that to develop in unwholesome ways. And this became quite clear to me. I could see that, when you support the Norwegian sports person, but you don't care about everyone else, you feel your mind narrow down, excluding other people, and you become this kind of slightly chauvinistic person as a consequence, which obviously is going to be very, very bad in the long run. It becomes an us and them thing, us versus them, and prioritizing always the us versus the other people outside. And if you keep on doing that, the more you identify with whatever it is, and of course identity goes far, far beyond nationality. If you think about all the things that you identify with as a person, things, obvious thing is something like gender, very obvious, social status, education, how wealthy you are, your ethnic background that you have, the culture that you belong to, whatever that is. and many, many more things as well. These are the things that, as a cumulative whole, creates our identities. And the stronger we hold on to those identities, the more problem actually can arise. When you have this us and them mentality, very often it ends up with conflict. It ends up with problems. And some of the great intractable problems in the world, political problems, I'll talk about those in a second, actually arise out of this identity that we have. That is where it comes from. Not only interpersonal problems, but large international scale problems actually come from this root. So just to kind of talk a little bit first of all about the Buddha, how the Buddha analyzes this. And the Buddha says that any conflict that we have, it arises from one thing. The evil in Buddhism, which kind of gives rise to all of the bad things, is craving. Tanha in Pali, desire. Yeah, this is the thing that ultimately gives rise to all problems in the world. And there's two kinds of craving that gives rise to these problems. Yeah, when we are aggressive against others, or angry, or we go to war, or whatever it is. There's two types of craving, two types of desire that are the problem. And the first one is the kind of typical craving that we talk about all the time, the craving for sensual pleasures. I'll get back to that in a second. But this is kind of one of those very, this is probably the most important of these cravings, and quite hard to overcome. Yeah, it's very deep-seated, the idea of sensual craving. But there's another kind of craving, and that is called the craving for existence. It's called the bhava tanha. In Pali language. I hope you like Pali. You like Pali? Yeah? Because when you come to my talks, you're always going to hear a little bit of Pali. So if you don't like Pali, close your ears. That's what I recommend. Okay, whatever. So, bhava tanha, craving for existence. Yeah? And this is the problem I'm talking about now. The craving, the identity that we have. Because once you crave to exist, it means you crave to be somebody, you crave to be here, then the identity emerges from that. And then that craving, that identity, then leads on to the problems in the world where we have conflicts with each other because of conflicting identities and all of these kind of things. I'll come back to the problems that arise from identity in a second, but let me just briefly, first of all, talk a little bit about the problems that arise from sensual craving, why this is a problem. I've talked about this here before, but it's still kind of interesting nonetheless. The idea, of course, that if we are attached and interested in the sensual pleasures of the world, then we are not the only ones who are interested in sensual pleasures, so is everyone else. And because everyone is interested in roughly the same sensual pleasures, yeah, we all want a larger piece of the cake, a larger kind of cutting of the pie, yeah, everyone wants more, it means someone else is going to get less. And because we all crave endlessly, and we all want more all the time, it is bound to give rise to conflict in the world. And the Buddha gives a nice simile about this, one of my little favorite similes that you find in the suttas. Suttas, by the way, are the discourses of the Buddha. And the Buddha says it's like a bird which has got hold of a piece of meat. Yeah, if a bird gets hold of a piece of meat, bird is very happy. Meat is difficult to find in bird world. Bird world usually have worms and you get kind of bugs and things, but a piece of meat is like prime food in the bird world. So somehow this bird gets a piece of meat, perhaps because the monks are feeding the birds. Yeah, that's possible, because that's what we do as monks. Sometimes when you go back to your kuti and we have a nice meal, we may have something left over. We think, oh, the kangaroos might like this, yeah? So we chuck out some chocolate cake to the kangaroo. Huh? And the kangaroo brightens up, yeah? Whoa, chocolate cake, yeah? You can see, the kangaroos are just like humans. They also prefer chocolate cake, yeah? There's no difference. Animal realm, human realm, pretty much the same. So you can see how this is how sometimes these birds get hold of a piece of meat, yeah? Because some monk or whoever it is kind of, chucks out something to them. And then this bird flies off with this piece of meat, really happy, yeah? Until it looks behind, and behind it there's another big flock of birds in hot pursuit, trying to get hold of that same piece of meat. Yeah, and eventually those other birds, because they are bigger or whatever, they catch up with that small bird. And when they catch up, they try to rip that piece of meat out of its claws. Yeah, because that is the nature of the animal world. The animal world is brutal. It's interesting, you know, when you come from Norway, you think that kangaroos are kind of cute and cuddly. That's what you think in Norway. Yeah? This is, we don't have any ideas, real ideas about kangaroos, but they look kind of really cute and cuddly when you see them on pictures. Yeah, all the kind of tourist brochures from Australia, very nice, you know, koalas and kangaroos and this kind of thing. But when you see them in nature, you actually realize how brutal it all is. The animal world is a very brutal place, full of desire, full of ill will, no care or concern for anyone. That is the reality of the animal world. And so these birds, they're chasing after each other, trying to rip away the piece of meat from the other ones. Yeah? And that, says the Buddha, is a simile for the nature of the sensual world. As soon as we have something nice, as soon as you find a nice partner to have a relationship with, someone else wants the same partner. Has that ever happened to you? You find someone nice and then eventually you get together and you still feel a bit jealous, yeah, because your partner might be interested in someone else. You still want to hold on to them a little bit. There's this endless problem with relationships, is that there's never that full, there cannot be that full sense of security. That's only one of them. That's one way in which sensual pleasures is problematic. Of course, many other ways, how we fight or we compete over salaries, we compete over promotions in our job. As children, we might fight over a toy, then we fight over the inheritance when our parents die, and it goes on and on and on like that. We always want a larger piece of that pie. The economic pie is only so large, there's only so much to go around. It doesn't matter how fast the national product increases every year, it's kind of irrelevant, because we always want more and more regardless. And for that reason, it's always going to be competitive. It's always going to lead to conflict. And this is one of those really awful things. When you reflect on this and you realize that this is true, it kind of makes you very wary of the whole world around us. The whole sensual world seems so unpleasant suddenly, because it's always involved with conflict and problems and violence and a lack of peace for that reason. It's inherent to that world. It can't be otherwise. We try to create institutions that create stability in the world, that create a sense of harmony, a way of mediating between people and nations. We don't go to war with each other, at least less often than we used to. Still, it happens. Many of the large wars in the world are based on the idea that we want to secure products for our country, secure resources so that our economy can grow and whatever it is. Ultimately, it comes back to sensual pleasures. So that is one craving and why it leads to problems. But the other one I was just talking about is the identity, yeah, the craving for existence and what our identity actually is. And again, it is fairly obvious, yeah, on the surface, that when you have the sense of identity, you will have a little, it will have an othering feeling, an othering result. Other people will feel a bit more other, different. Yeah, there will be a distance there between yourself and others when you have a sense of identity. But sometimes when you look at some of the great problems in the world, some of the very large problems that are still going on, and some of them have been going on for hundreds and thousands of years, actually they too are based on that idea of identity. And one of those problems, of course, that is very well known for being sourced in identity is the conflict in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, they have, you know, you had the Catholics on the one side and the Protestants on the other side, trying to kind of live together, well, not very well at all, yeah, really messing it up, and the sense of identity. Yeah, and this is really an identity conflict. We are Catholics, Irish, we are Protestants, Unionists, we want to be part of the UK. And that identity conflict has caused, I read this somewhere recently, over 3,000 deaths over a few decades. 3,000 deaths in a tiny community. Northern Ireland has something like 1.5 million inhabitants. It's tiny, it's smaller than the city of Perth. Yeah, Perth has, I don't know how much, it's more than that, I think, a couple of million or something. Tiny little place. Over 3,000 deaths. 50,000 people injured. Yeah, due to what? Due to this conflict between people because of identity. And identity is all there is to it. And from a Buddhist point of view, if you look at the Catholic religion or the Protestants, the Church of England, or whatever it is that they are, it seems so marginal. What's the difference anyway? You have the same God, Christian God. You have the same scriptures, for goodness sake, the same Bible. So what is the difference? If I were to ask you, how many here would even be able to tell the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant? I probably couldn't, to be honest with you, but there's probably something to do with how you practice it, the external rituals and a few things like that, and I don't know, transubstantiation and these kind of things, some sort of theology behind it. But the difference is tiny, yeah, compared to, from a Buddhist point of view, it seems so ridiculous. And sometimes when the smallest kind of differences are the ones that make us the most fundamentalist, that lead to the greatest, problems. The people we argue with most as Theravadan monks, we try to avoid arguments, but if we ever argue, it's other Theravadan monks. Yeah? If I ever argue, well, it's people like Venerable Jayako is the one I probably, actually we never really argue. But, that's what happens, yeah? Because if you have a tiny difference in view, but you are the same tradition, that is somehow, that threatens your identity probably more than anything else. Christians, okay, we kind of write them off because they are so far away anyway. Muslims doesn't matter, yeah? But those who are very close to you, that is where the problems often arise. Another of these great identity conflicts in the world, I think, is the conflict in Israel between the Palestinians and the Jews. The Jewish identity is probably very strong because of long terms of oppression and problems for the Jewish people. And that creates a very strong identity. And then you have the Palestinians on the other side who have also a fairly strong identity probably through Islam and all of that. And that also is a conflict that has been going on for how long? 3,000 years or something like that. It kind of goes back almost to the beginning of history, at least in the Western world. It's kind of ridiculous. And they're still fighting over it after 3,500 years because of a very strongly felt sense of identity. We are Jews, we are Muslims, and there's no way that we're going to be able to cooperate. And of course, then it doesn't happen. Maybe the way to resolve the conflict in Israel is to try to reduce that sense of identity a little bit. To actually, instead of looking at the differences between people, start to see, look at those things that we have in common as human beings. It's kind of crazy, because what we have in common as human beings is far more than what differentiates us. What differentiates us is only superficial things, marginal things. But if we look inside our mind and hearts, what we actually want in life, we all want to have a reduction in problems, we all want more contentment and satisfaction and peace and all of these kind of things. What we want, what we're aiming for, where we want to go, we are very similar in so many ways. The defilements in our hearts are pretty much the same. It's only the superficial stuff that is different. So why do we make so much out of these differences? This is how pernicious the idea of identity is. The reality of identity is very pernicious. It divides us, where actually there is a lot of grounds for unifying us instead. But the third one, and I like to kind of bring out also Buddhist problems as well, not kind of blame everyone else and kind of think that Buddhists are always better, because we're not. Sometimes Buddhists also make similar kind of mistakes. And of course, the Buddhist kind of paramount conflict where identity has also been a problem has probably been in Burma in recent years. The conflict between the Muslims and the Rohingyas, and that has been essentially, the Buddhists have been saying the reason why we are afraid of the Rohingya Muslims is basically because of identity. They are destroying Buddhism. This is our religion. We want to be Buddhist. We don't want someone from the outside to destroy what we have. So instead of practicing the Buddhist teachings, they have made Buddhism into another identity. They take pride in that identity. And then when they feel that that identity is threatened, it is as if they themselves are threatened. And then they can't let go. Again, even Buddhists, we make the same mistake. Even when the Buddha specifically said, this is a dangerous area, maybe because we're not educated well enough about the Buddhist teachings, we also make that same mistake. And all of these things are really related a little bit to, you can see here, this is all politics, yeah? Politics and identity coming together, and this is where it becomes very bad. And in recent years, there's one of these kind of politics that has been promoted around the world, which is called identity politics. And you may have heard about that. It has been kind of probably started in the United States. Many things start in the U.S. and it's spread around the world afterwards. I don't want to blame the Americans, but often it starts there, yeah, and it spreads around afterwards. But to me, straight away, when you talk about identity politics, to me, it reminds me a little bit of Northern Ireland. It reminds me a little bit of what's happening in Israel, because these are very powerful examples of identity politics. It makes it kind of scary to me when I hear the term identity politics. You have to use it very carefully here. If you take it too far, it leads to division, it leads to conflict. So you have to be very, very careful with these kind of tools. And I must admit, I'm always a little bit concerned about these things, precisely because they can go in the wrong direction. So what are we to do? What can we do about this? How can we reduce the sense of identity? Or how can we change it in such a way that we reduce the problem and we actually make a world that is less conflict-filled, that is more stable, and where we can have more harmony between each other? How can we do this? And the first thing is to realize that the sense of identity is something we cannot choose not to have. You cannot wish it away or kind of just sweep it away under the carpet and no longer have an identity. You have to have some kind of identity here. And the reason for that is because, from a Buddhist point of view, we all have a sense of self. We all feel that we exist in a certain way. And that sense of self needs to express itself. It needs some kind of identification by which it can actually make sense. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to have a self unless it has certain characteristics, certain things that it actually relates to. Yeah, so once that sense of self is there, and for the vast majority, unless you're fully enlightened, and usually I ask how many fully enlightened people there are in the audience, but I've given up on that because usually people are too shy to say if they are. Maybe there are some arahants at the back, but they never raise their hands, those arahants. So... it is an aspect of almost all human beings, yeah? And arahants are very few and far between. Because of that, we have no choice but to have an identity of some sort. And this is the first thing to remember, yeah? You cannot choose these things away, yeah? So what we have to do instead, we have to redirect our sense of identity here into such a way that it is supportive of harmony, supportive of the spiritual practice, supportive of a better world. And if we redirect our sense of identity in that way, then it becomes far less pernicious, far less problematic, and then actually it can become useful and even supportive of how we live our life. So how do we do that? And instead of identifying with all these superficial things like I've just been talking about before, especially nationality, yeah, whether you are Norwegian or Aussie, who cares whether you're Norwegian or Aussie? Nobody cares anyway. And so it's irrelevant. So forget about that. Forget about that particular thing. Instead, we identify with something, an aspect of the Buddhist practice, the Buddhist path. So you, all of you here are already good people. If you weren't a good person, you wouldn't be here. You already have the right inclination. You already have some of the right attitude. Yeah, you're already heading in the right direction. So count the good things in your life. Count the number of precepts you are keeping. Many of you here will be keeping the 5 precepts pretty much all the time. And what a wonderful thing that is, to have that aspiration to live a life of moral purity. You may not think of yourself as any kind of super-duper spiritual person, but you're probably far better than you think sometimes, because you're already doing many of the right things. And when you think like that, when you think, yeah, actually, I'm doing quite a few good things. I'm kind, I'm supportive, I'm generous. I'm living a life of kindness and moral purity as far as I'm able to. Don't expect perfection, because if you expect perfection, you're just going to let yourself down. Don't put the bar too high. Instead of rejoice, instead, in the few things that you are able to do. And then when you start to look at your spiritual life in that way, and you rejoice quietly within yourself, without making too much ego out of it, then you start to feel good about yourself. And when you feel good about yourself because how you live, because of your spiritual qualities, then it is easy to identify with that. Because any identity we have is about feeling good about ourselves, right? That's why you feel good about being whatever it is. Yeah, I'm educated, I'm whatever it is that you identify with, you feel good about it. So you find something to make you happy in the spiritual practice, to make you feel content and satisfied with yourself, and that is what you identify with. So those Buddhists in Burma who identify as Buddhists, yeah, and then they go to war almost, or they do bad things or whatever it is to the Rohingyas, instead of identifying as Buddhists, they should identify as Buddhist practitioners, as people who are kind, as people who are caring, as people who support others. And if you identify with those things, it is almost impossible to have come into conflict and trouble with other people. Because those very qualities are those that undermine conflict and problems in the world. And then you keep on practicing in this way. You keep on identifying as you practice a spiritual path. You identify more and more with the beautiful qualities in your heart. The growing sense of compassion and care, the growing sense of loving kindness for the people around you, the growing sense of peace that is arising inside of you. And as you do that, that idea of harmony and ability to live with others increases all along, until eventually there is no distinction anymore between you and other people. It's just one mass of beings, and you can no longer discriminate or even differentiate between yourself or others. I'll come back to this in a second, because this is such an important part of this whole Buddhist path, ending up in a place where there's absolutely no discrimination or even distinction between people. Everyone is seen roughly as the same. So this is the first step that we can do. Yeah? Start to identify in a different way. Identify with the good qualities of our heart rather than all the superficial identities that we tend to have as human beings. And then everything gets better from that. But before I come back to the idea of meditation practice and how this supports this feeling of non-identity, I want to look at this from a slightly different angle as well. And this is one of my kind of favorite suttas. I've got so many favorite suttas, but anyway, there's many. Actually, the whole Tipitaka is my favorite. So whatever sutta in the Tipitaka is, I quote, is always my favorite sutta. And there's how many suttas in the Tipitaka? People count in different ways, but one rough estimate is 10,000. So I got 10,000 favorite discourses by the Buddha. So it doesn't mean all that much when I say favorite. But anyway, it is one of my favorites. according to this sutta, it shows you how the mind is refined, yeah, how the spiritual path goes. It starts off from the very basic, the very beginning of the spiritual path, and it takes it all the way to the very end. It shows the gradual movement of the spiritual practice from the beginning to the very end. And it has a very beautiful simile in the sutta, the simile of the refinement of gold. Yeah, gold, how gold is refined is similar to how we refine the mind. Now the first thing you will notice here, which is very nice, yeah, is the idea of gold being compared to the mind. You may not be aware that you have a big lump of gold in here. Can you feel the gold? They say it's a gray mass, but I say it's a gold that we have in here. That's what I say. Do you agree with that? Why does the Buddha compare the mind to gold? Actually, it's nothing to do with the brain, it's the mind anyway. I'm just messing around a bit. But, you know, why does the Buddha compare the mind to gold? Well, and the reason is because gold, if it is not purified, if it is full of impurities, it doesn't look very nice. Yeah, it doesn't shine, it's not bright, it's just, yeah, whatever. It just looks like pretty much like dust, like everything else. And there's exactly the same thing with the mind. Yeah, if the mind is full of defilements, lots of craving and ill will or whatever, it's not very, it's kind of not very nice. Yeah, it's not very beautiful. But gold, when you refine it, you get rid of all the impurities, when it shines and is powerful and bright and brilliant, it becomes very beautiful. And the Buddha said the mind is just like that. Yeah, when you purify the mind in the right way, following this gradual stages that the Buddha talks about, it becomes brilliant and pure and bright, just like gold. You have a lump of gold in your heart or in your mind, whatever you want to say. It's there. It's just waiting to be shined up. And when it gets shined up, it becomes so valuable. It becomes the most valuable thing that you can possibly have in your whole life. Far, far, far more valuable, of course, than gold itself. So gold is just the closest we get to an idea of how valuable the mind is. It's super duper valuable. Why? Because it is the ultimate source of happiness in our life. If we do things in the right way, if we purify it in the right way, we can create this inner gold in our heart. This is what the Buddha is talking about. So how do we do that? And the way we do that, it is through a gradual process. And the point of this gradual process is that it has to happen through certain stages. You have to get the process right. If you get the process wrong, it's not going to work. If you have gold, yeah, and it's coming straight out of the ground, you have just kind of been rinsing it, getting the nuggets out of the river or whatever it is, you have to get the defilements out. You have to start with the coarse defilements, yeah? You can't start with the most refined sand or whatever. You have to start with the gravel and the big things. Yeah, you have to do it. If you do it in this way, then it might work out. But if you start to try to get the sand out first or the very refined things out first, it's not going to work. So you start out getting the gravel out, then you get the coarse sand out, then you get the dust particles out, yeah? And eventually you heat the gold in the furnace and you kind of blow out the remnant of dust or whatever is left in that gold. It's a gradual process and you have to do it in those particular steps, otherwise it doesn't work. And the Buddha says it's exactly the same thing with the mind. You have to start with the very coarse aspects of the mind. So you have to ask yourself, what are the problems that you have? What is the biggest problem in your life? So you start off by keeping some precepts, yeah, some basic things of morality that make you a better person. This is the first step. So once you have those five precepts in place, then you ask yourself, can I do something more? Can I be more kind in the way I speak to other people? Can I be more kind in the way I think about other people, yeah? That is the next step. And then the third step then is how to purify your mind even further. Purify your mind from all thoughts of ill will and anger. That is the third step. But you have to get these things in the right order. And this is a big problem in Buddhism. Very often people don't understand this. And because they don't understand this, they get things in the wrong order, they are really upset and angry, and they sit down to meditate straight away, thinking that meditation is going to help them overcome the anger. It's not. Yeah? Meditation is not going to help you overcome the anger. The anger is overcome by thinking in the right way. Then when your anger or ill will or your strong desires or whatever it is subsides through reflecting and thinking in the right way, then meditation becomes possible. Then you can meditate. Remember, there is a sequence here. Know what your problem is. Deal with that big problem first of all. Then you can move on to the next step. These things happen in the right way. So eventually, yeah, if you keep on practicing in this way, then eventually there comes a point when your mind is very pure, very nice, but still you don't kind of have that absolute sense of stillness and peace that we are aiming for on the Buddhist path. And what is it that stops us from achieving that very last stillness? And the Buddha says, very interestingly, the very most refined of these defilements that stop us from achieving the full peace, he says, is our nationality. Yeah, thoughts about nationality, thoughts about our family, thoughts about our reputation. Yeah, in other words, thinking about our identity. Yeah, that is, in a sense, the kind of the last problem, the most subtle of all the defilements that stops you from actually entering deep meditation states. Of course, the identity problems arise long before that, but it also is the most subtle things that stop us from meditation practice. So, very interesting how far this goes and how it stops us at the very end of the Buddhist path from achieving deep states of meditation. So, what does this mean in practice? And what it means in practice is that if you do follow this path in the right way, if you do purify yourself gradually, and then one day you come to the Dhammaloka Center, you take part in the meditation practices that we do here, and maybe you follow Ajahn Brahm's way of doing meditation, which really is just the Buddha's way, really. He's just following what you find in the suttas. We're watching the breath and all of these kind of things. One of the interesting things that you will find in your meditation is, of course, that sometimes the mind wants to think about things. Often sometimes it wants to think about things. Sometimes it doesn't want to be quiet at all. And if you start to analyze and look at the kind of things that the mind is thinking about, you will see that a substantial portion of the thinking mind has to do with your identity. Yeah, it has to do with who you are. You're thinking about yourself in terms of these relationships that you have to the external world, who you are. In fact, one of the things that you will find is that as the mind becomes peaceful, sometimes it's almost as if the mind rebels against the peace. Because when the peace becomes too much, you are losing a large part of your sense of identity. Yeah, the identity is no longer there. Identity is built up by thinking about these things. Thinking, yeah, I'm an Aussie now. I've got an Aussie passport. Yeah, I got my Aussie passport today. I did actually, it's true. I'm not joking. And so now I'm an Aussie, yeah? And you kind of think, oh, Aussie, okay, this is really good. Now I can do all of these kind of things that Aussies can do. Somebody said to me, oh, yeah, you're going to come down to the pub now and have a beer, someone said to me. That's what Aussies do. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll think about it, I said. So, but these things actually happen in your meditation practice, yeah? Your mind becomes peaceful, that sense of identity is subdued. And sometimes the mind doesn't like that because it just loses a sense of self, loses a sense of who you think you are, and the mind rebels, and then it will think about it after all, and it will kind of ruminate about all of these kind of things. So this is part of the problem in meditation practice. But after a while, you start to become peaceful anyway. And what I will ask you to notice in your meditation practice is that when you actually do overcome that sense of identity, when you don't think about anything anymore, when the mind is peaceful, what does it feel like? Does it feel nice? It feels beautiful, doesn't it? It feels so nice when you can leave the whole world to the side, forget about the entire world, and all you do is have a sense of peace and have nothing else, no thoughts going through your mind. And when you realize that, when you see the problem with all this thinking and all of these things, you understand that identity actually is a big problem, because identity is something that hinders the peace inside of you. And if you look at the world in this way, if you enjoy the peace of meditation practice, you get a very high incentive to let go of your sense of identity. Who cares if I'm Australian, Norwegian, Sri Lankan, whatever it is? It's kind of utterly irrelevant. And the more deeper you go in the meditation, the less sense of your identity there is. Actually, you stop feeling like any of these things. Yeah, there's nothing inside of you. There's no sign there saying Aussie or whatever. Yeah, that kind of disappears. Your gender starts to disappear, because in the peace of the mind, that's genderless. And all of these other signs as well of identity that we have, they don't exist anymore. The deeper the meditation is, the less these things actually exist. Identity is gradually disappearing, and it's so marvelous. It is so beautiful. It's such a happy state of mind. All of this self business, all of this identity that we're holding on to, clinging on to, it's just dukkha, it's problem, it's suffering. The less we have of that, the better it is. And of course, it has the added advantage, as we reduce our sense of identity, as we identify more with just being kind, with just being good-hearted, with being compassionate, we identify with these beautiful states of peace inside of us. It also means that when we come out of the meditation afterwards, we look at people in a different way, because we understand that all people, in fact all beings, whatever they are, have these internal states of peace available inside of them if they practice in the right way. So you start to see a unity in humanity. You start to see a unity which goes beyond all the superficial identity business. And this is one of those beautiful things that you find in meditation practice. And eventually, you keep on. You take it even deeper. You go deeper and deeper and deeper. And the deeper you go, the less identity there is. In fact, the deepest stages of meditation, they are stages where all the barriers in the world are removed. There's no barriers between you and other people anymore. There's an expanse of loving kindness, of compassion, of peace, or whatever it is, just radiating across the entire world, without boundary, without limits, without anything. And you can imagine that kind of state. Some of you may already have experienced some of these states, at least a little bit. And you know how powerful it is, how non-discriminative it is, how you bring everyone together into one feeling. And there's no longer any us and them, me and other. Suddenly you are actually really embracing the whole world with compassion and loving kindness. And what a wonderful thing that is. At that point, there is no identity anymore, or identity is universalized. Everything is brought into one identity almost. At that point, of course, no harm can happen anymore. No discrimination, no more wars based on identity. In fact, all of those qualities are the exact opposite. They are qualities that unite, bring us together, create harmony and happiness, contentment and peace in the world. And this is where that is heading here. So, just to very briefly summarize the point of this talk, and the point of this talk is just to show that the usual sense of identity that we have in the world is problematic and tends to lead to conflict. And what we need to do on the Buddhist path is to shift that sense of identity and shift it towards qualities that align with the Buddhist path, qualities of kindness, of care, of generosity and compassion, and take that deeper and deeper and deeper in our practice until eventually identity is almost eliminated entirely. You go into a deep state of meditation and the world is just one. There is loving kindness for all beings, wherever they may be, whatever they are. And eventually you go even beyond that. Eventually, on the Buddhist path, you destroy, you not really destroy, you eliminate, you overcome the sense of identity once and for all. And this is one of the meanings of being fully awakened or enlightened on the Buddhist path, that the identity is eliminated once and for all, and it never comes back again. And when you are in the presence of people like that, who have eliminated identity once and for all, it's very beautiful, because you feel they treat everybody the same. Yeah, everyone is the same to them. They have kindness for everyone. Occasionally, you may meet people like that, and I have met a few people like that in my life who are very special. There's a beautiful sense of acceptance in their presence. There's a feeling that they will never really discriminate or harm you in any way, regardless of who you are, regardless of where you come from, regardless of your superficial identity. Okay, enough for tonight. Okay, so that is a little talk on identity for you. Is there any questions from anyone here?
Ajahn Brahmamli, yeah. Me again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for the really wonderful talk, you know. The Buddha was telling us that one of the characteristics of human existence is that there's no self, and also things are impermanent. The thing is, now coming back to identity, what you're saying is, okay, it's okay to have identity, but do you think sometimes if the identity goes too much self-cherishing,
Yeah.
then that's where the problem comes, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I think it is impossible not to have an identity. So identity is always going to be there. Yeah, it's always going to be in the background. For that reason, you can't just eliminate it. Mm. So we try to have, as you say, positive identity. Mm. Yeah, you identify with your positive traits as a person.
Yeah.
And of course, we're going to have other identities as well. Mm. But we try to move in that direction.
Yeah.
And as we do that, we are moving away from the problematic identity and moving towards a more accepting and positive identity.
Yeah. Also, for us to be great again, our country be great again, we have to put the others down, you know. We are up, that, and they are down all, you know.
And that's the problem.
Why can't it be we are up, we're all together up, you know.
Yeah, much better.
Instead of that self-cherishing thing.
Yeah.
And could this have come from religions too, John Bramley? Like religions, they are like a
absolutely. You know, like, yeah, you know, that's like, a very good point.
Yeah,
that's
we are like point. A, yeah. How do I say, it's only us, you know, the others are down, you know.
Yeah. I fully agree, but religion has part of the problem, and that's why I mentioned Buddhism before. Like, you know, sometimes Buddhists have the same problem as well, and other religions have the same problem, because religion is a very powerful identity, yeah, very strong one, and I should have mentioned that in my talk, so thank you for bringing it up. Very strong identity, and if we use that in the wrong way, it can become very destructive. So we have to use that identity in religion in a positive way to make it work. Yeah.
Sorry, to a point where it comes to mistrust in the world now, we have to learn the world to trust each other, you know, to make the world a better place to live.
Yeah, good, yeah. There's one question over here, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I grew up 35 years in Israel, as you know. So in a way I have an Israeli identity. However, if you push a knife through my body, through my head, and if you push a knife, imagine you push it, it's pretty cruel, but
I promise not to do that.
You cut me in half.
Yeah.
Where is Israeli?
Yeah.
You weren't going to find any Israeli. You're going to find neurons, synapses in my brain, organs in my body, veins. So where is Israeli? So it is, this identity is I think, is an illusion. It's an illusion we get maybe by evolution, maybe by conditioning, indoctrination. I don't know if I find the right words, but
conditioning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Conditioning.
Yeah.
So for me, I understand that it doesn't exist really. Maybe it exists in the stream of thoughts that are ever changing anyway, and we can with the right reconditioning we can change that, but not anywhere in the body. But thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian context, the identity over there in the Middle East is so powerful, so strong. So I don't think if I need to be practical, reducing that sense of identity. If I need to be practical, I don't see that happening. But I do what I do for someone that experienced that conflict on my flesh. What I do see happening is changing the narrative, starting changing the narrative. So in a way, I'm the Jewish Israeli, right? If I need to wear that hat for a second, I respect your identity over the fence. I acknowledge your needs, or I care about that sort of language. I would hope.
Yeah.
That will happen. I don't think you will be ever.
I largely agree with that. I think the thing is that the reason I just brought up those points is not so much that I intend to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah, sure.
I have no ambition or even thought that I could possibly make an make any impact. But I think the point is more that when we see the problems that it gives rise to, it gives a spur in our own practice to avoid the same problem in our own personal life. And that's really what I'm talking about. I'm talking to individual people rather than trying to resolve large-scale conflicts. But by understanding where those large-scale conflicts come from, we can actually enhance our own ability to ensure that we don't make the same mistakes in our private practice.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so this is from outside the center. Thank you very much. So only two questions tonight. So this is from DY from the USA. Do you think identity craving for self-image is the same or lesser or more since the time of the Buddha with the progress of science and technology? Okay, so the identity, has identity become stronger over time and the craving for identity becomes stronger over time, perhaps? Is that the case? Well, that's a good question. It may very well be, and maybe kind of the way we kind of communicate on the internet now, I'm not really, with the all the kind of arguments people have on the internet or whatever, maybe that strengthens a sense of self. The idea that you're always kind of playing to an audience when you write something on Facebook or whatever, a lot of people will see what you write, so it's not like you're communicating with a person, it's like you're performing for an audience instead. And of course, the more we perform for an audience, the more a sense of self will always be involved. So perhaps all this internet stuff is actually increasing our sense of self in that way. That, of course, can be problematic. So I think you may have a point, but really the point is that wherever you are in the world, I mean, sometimes, certain societies are regarded as more individualistic, perhaps, than others, etc. But these are small differences. In the end, every society, every person has an identity, and every person will tend to satisfy that demand for an identity through all of these external things like social position or wealth or education or intelligence or whatever it is. We will try to satisfy it through those things unless we have something more profound that we can satisfy that sense of identity with, eventually overcoming that sense of identity completely. So you may be right that it is getting worse, but I don't think it really matters all that much. It's the same process that we have to get through. Second question is from Pam from Scotland. Do you think that sometimes people can use cultural identity as an excuse for bad behavior? And I would say absolutely. Certainly that is the case. And very often the cultural identity, because we want to preserve our culture, culture is often elevated in our society as being something very important, and everyone should be proud of the culture. The moment you are proud of your culture, you're going to identify with your culture. So I would say all of this idea of being proud of ourselves, proud of our identity, proud of our culture, I don't know how wise that actually is. I'm not saying we should be kind of the opposite of proud. What is that? Looking down upon our culture. But we should just kind of try to be neutral, without being too puffed up nor being too depressed about things. But find that middle way whereby culture is nice, but it's no big deal. That is, I think, the ideal thing. As long as you're proud about it or you feel bad about it, eventually you will also fight for it and maybe do bad things in the name of that culture. So best to leave all of that aside a little bit. Anyway, that is all for tonight. Everyone happy? Anyone not happy? No? Okay. You're not happy? Yeah, please.
On a nice note, little lighter.
Please.
Now you are an Aussie.
Yeah.
You know what you're supposed to go and do?
What is that?
Have a frontal lobotomy.
Okay. No, yeah, okay.
That's what they make you do. So you can belong.
Okay. Are you a Kiwi by any chance?
No. Okay. I'm an Aussie too.
Are you? Okay, Aussie as well. Okay. Yeah. Okay, very good. Okay, very good. So let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha to finish off.